You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2024 on Monocle Radio. It's 1900 in Beijing, 1400 in Istanbul, midday here in London, and 7am in New York City. You're listening to Monocle Radio. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. Ahead on today's programme...
Europe and China have a shared interest in peace and security. We count on China to use all its influence on Russia to end Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen makes the EU's priorities clear. We'll get the latest on Xi Jinping's first European tour in 5 years. Then, after Turkey suspends trade with Israel, the country looks to its European allies for support. And as student protests continue to shake university campuses across the globe, we'll ask one Princeton professor what lessons can be learned. And finally...
It's just like a Superman version of myself. Like, it's give the permission to be no rules when I'm Windows 95. When I put the hot pants on, I'm always feeling like a happy, free man.
Finland's Eurovision entry looks set to bring the heat at this weekend's song contest. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Georgina Godwin. Chinese Premier Xi Jinping is on a state visit to Europe, his first in 5 years. He's been in Paris meeting the French President Emmanuel Macron and head of the European Commission Ursula von der Leyen. Tomorrow he'll go on to Belgrade for talks with Serbia's President Aleksandar Vučić. And on Thursday he'll go to Budapest where he'll meet Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. The visit comes at a time when China-EU ties are under strain from trade disputes and Russia's war on Ukraine. Well, joining me here in the studio is David Schlesinger, who's an independent advisor and commentator on media, journalism and China. David, many thanks for coming into the studio today. I wonder if the choice of itinerary is a direct message to the US. Are the Belgrade and Budapest stops part of China's efforts to deepen division within the West?
Well, it's not just a message to Washington. It's also a message to other countries in Europe. So China's president is actually playing three-dimensional chess here. On one board, he's trying to divide and conquer Europe from the US. He doesn't want the EU or Europe writ large to simply follow Biden slash Trump in a very strong anti-China stance. And choosing Paris as the first stop is probably very wise because Macron certainly doesn't want to be seen as anybody's puppet, let alone the United States' puppet. So that's one game that he's playing. But on the next level, he's also trying to exploit divisions within Europe itself, because you have not only within the EU, but also throughout Europe, you have many different views on China. So Serbia is probably the friendliest country towards China whatsoever. It was one of the first, well, actually Hungary was the first to sign up for the Belt and Road, but Serbia has been very, very active in the Belt and Road, taking Chinese money for infrastructure projects. And neither Serbia nor Hungary have much interest in economic sanctions against China. They want to use Chinese money, Chinese industry, and certainly neither of those leaders have much interest in any of the human rights issues.
So the visit to Paris marks 60 years since diplomatic relations were established between France and China. And France was, in fact, I think, the first Western country to formally recognise the People's Republic of China. That was back in 64. How have relations between the two mutated over time?
France and China have always had a very interesting relationship. Even before the formal relations, many of the Chinese revolutionaries studied in France. They always had felt a connection to France. And I think France always had a certain romantic view towards the communist revolution, even during some of the most turbulent times. So, of course, France is a Western country, and during times like the Tiananmen Square crackdown, it followed the rest of the West in condemning that. But France has always been quite friendly towards China and quite open towards China.
And what was the readout from Monday's meeting?
Look, I think you played a clip where Ursula von der Leyen really emphasized the Russia aspect, the Ukraine aspect. And I think that underscores exactly what the problem Europe has with China, because prior to that readout, the key issue was economic. What is the EU going to do about China's electric vehicles? What kind of investigation do they want to have about overcapacity? And yes, those issues were raised, and tough talk, of course. But the EU is in a bit of a bind because they want China for other purposes as well. They cannot just have a strong economic line because they need China to at least be a moderating influence on Putin, even if they can't get China to actually stop the war.
So she moves on to Serbia tomorrow. And again, the timing, interestingly, coincides with another important anniversary, and that's the 25 years since the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Serbia. And I wonder how you'd then characterise Beijing's relationship with Belgrade and what will then be on the agenda with Vučić.
Well, let's be clear. Who bombed the embassy? The United States bombed the embassy. The United States bombed the embassy in 1999 as part of a NATO maneuver. So I think this underscores exactly what China's issue in Ukraine is, that China actually agrees with Putin's line that NATO is dangerous or can be dangerous, and that NATO expansionism is almost by definition dangerous because China has a visceral feel for it. Three Chinese were killed in this bombing, and the embassy was badly damaged. Now, of course, NATO has always said, oh, this is a mistake. The United States paid reparations. The CIA made a public apology saying, oh, we got our coordinates wrong. But nobody in China actually believes that. Everybody in China thinks that the United States targeted China for some reason. And so this underscores the suspicion that China has, that Xi has, about the West, about the U.S., and about NATO. And I think it goes a long way towards explaining why China has been able or felt the necessity to side with Putin more in the Ukraine conflict.
And I think Viktor Orban agrees with him on many of those points. So what's going to happen in the meeting in Hungary? That's on Thursday.
Look, I think a lot of this is about economic ties to Hungary. I mean, I mentioned that the EU is looking at Chinese electric vehicles in particular. Well, Hungary has announced that China is going to build an electric vehicle factory in Hungary itself. And there's talk that during this visit, they may announce a new electric battery factory as well. So that would go around all the sanctions or any tariffs that the rest of the EU wants to put on. It would give China a direct foothold within the EU to put its low-cost but high-quality electric vehicles in the market.
David, thank you very much indeed. That was David Schlesinger. And now, here's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Israel has claimed control of the Gazan side of the Rafah crossing, which runs between Gaza and Egypt. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees calls the development extremely concerning and warned of the impact on international aid entering the territory. The announcement follows what the IDF calls targeted strikes against Hamas in eastern Rafah. The US and most European countries are boycotting Vladimir Putin's inauguration as Russian president today. He secured a widely disputed fifth term in a March election that critics say lacks democratic legitimacy. France, Hungary and Slovakia are expected to send representatives to the ceremony, despite a plea by Kyiv. And the winners of the Pulitzer Prizes have been announced at Columbia University in New York. They include The Washington Post, The New York Times and ProPublica in the journalism categories, as well as authors Jane Ann Phillips and Jonathan Eig. The Pulitzers also issued special citations to journalists and writers covering the war in Gaza and to the late hip-hop critic Greg Tate. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Georgina.
Thank you, Paige. It's time now for a look at the latest business headlines with Victoria Scholar, who's head of investment at Interactive Investor. Victoria, welcome back to the programme. We're starting with oil giant BP today.
Yes, that's right. It reported a quarterly update which disappointed investors. Its first quarter earnings came in at $2.7 billion, which is down 40% year on year and below analysts' expectations. Despite that, it is still returning cash to shareholders with a dividend and a share buyback program of $1.75 billion over the next 3 months. And it's planning to deliver $2 billion in cost savings by the end of 2026. But unlike its rival Shell, which managed to report earnings last week, which were slightly better than expected, BP has been weighed down by lower energy prices and weaker margins. And it's also had problems relating to a US refinery power outage earlier in the year.
And then to Apple, there's a new product launch.
Yes, that's right. So all eyes are on its new product launch event called Let Loose today. We're looking at potential new iPad Pro models. That's going to be the highlight of the event, really. But I think Wall Street is going to be more focused on Apple's AI reveal at its Worldwide Developer Conference in June. Last week, it reported results as well, which weren't as bad as many had feared. iPhone sales were down, but not as much as some people had expected. But there was some negative news over the weekend because the billionaire investor Warren Buffett disclosed that he had sold a big stake in Apple, which sent shares in the tech giant lower yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Now, we know that there are high mortgage rates here in the UK. Why then are house prices still going up?
Well, I think the main reason really is a chronic shortage of housing supply. So even though affordability pressures continue to be a major feature of the housing market at the moment, with interest rates in the UK at 16-year highs of 5.25% from the Bank of England, there just aren't enough houses to go around. So typically we'd see a sell-off in the housing market when affordability pressures intensify. But because of that shortage of supply, it means that we haven't seen that big sell-off we might otherwise have expected.
Victoria, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You're back with The Briefing. Now, we've been reporting how Turkey is suspending ties with Israel over the worsening humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And joining me for an update is Istanbul correspondent and Monocle Radio regular Hannah Lucinda Smith. Hannah, how effective is this trade ban?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is it's likely to harm Turkey far more than it harmed Israel. There was about $6.8 billion of bilateral trade between the two in 2023. 76% of that was Turkish exports, particularly things like steel, construction materials, some agricultural products. I think it is Turkey that sort of stands to lose the most, economically at least. But really, Erdogan had been left with little choice. He'd kind of backed himself into a corner with the Gaza issue. On the one hand, he's always made Palestine a really key part of his own profile. He sort of presents himself as this regional leader of the Muslims, kind of protector of the Muslims, always stood up very strongly for this Palestinian people, and indeed been close both to the Palestinian Authority and to Hamas. He hosted Hamas just a couple of weeks ago here in Istanbul. But at the same time, because of the volume of trade that does go between Turkey and Israel, and that's something that's only recently been restored after years of really bad diplomatic relations, he's kind of held off on stopping the trade. And it's pressure from his own backyard, actually, that's made him finally do it. There's a conservative part of Turkish society that we're getting increasingly restive about this kind of double-faced policy as they saw it. And in the local elections that were held here at the end of March, really Erdogan was punished in a lot of places for that. We saw a lot of his votes, his kind of core constituency, giving their votes instead to another conservative, a different conservative party. So, yeah, it's really a sort of corner that Erdogan has been backed into.
And are there countries in Europe who support Israel and might help in circumventing this trade ban?
Well, one of the really interesting things is that Azerbaijan is one of the countries that has the strongest relations with Israel. It's a Muslim country. It's very close to Turkey also. Turkey and Azerbaijan call themselves brotherly nations. And there is a pipeline that brings Azerbaijani oil to the Turkish Mediterranean coast, a place called Ceyhan. Now, there are questions now as to whether Turkey is going to keep allowing that Azerbaijani oil to be shipped from its port. You know, these kind of trade blockades throw up all these kind of questions. Certainly there were some journalists that went there on Sunday and saw that the fuel was still being loaded. So, you know, there are always, as we've seen with the sanctions that have been put on Russia and the way that they found ways around them, there are always ways around these kind of blockades.
Mm. Now, you've talked about the domestic pressure on Erdogan. What's he hoping, though, to achieve internationally? Is he wanting to insert himself at the centre of this dialogue?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been one of Erdogan's aims really since the 7th of October. We saw him back then very quickly, you know, offering himself as a mediator between Israel and Hamas. That really kind of fell flat. Israel doesn't, you know, have enough trust in Turkey as a kind of honest broker in that it sees it as far too close to Hamas. And very quickly, Qatar emerged as a kind of mediating power. But clearly, Turkey still does have a role to play. And I think, you know, Erdogan does have a very sort of high profile in the Muslim world. He's seen as somebody who really sort of sticks up for Muslims. And just today, he's receiving the Emir of Kuwait here in Turkey. And, you know, clearly that's going to be one of the things, Gaza is going to be one of the things on their agenda. You know, he's going to try and position himself as a kind of leading voice within the Muslim world.
Hannah, thank you very much indeed. That is Hannah Lucinda Smith speaking to us from Istanbul. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. As pro-Palestinian protests spread through universities across the world, more than a dozen students at Princeton in the US are on hunger strike. The demonstrators say this is a response to the administration's refusal to engage with the students' demands for disassociation and divestment from Israel. Well, Razia Iqbal is a visiting professor, the John L. Weinberg Visiting Professor in the School of Public and International Affairs, and she joins me now from Boston. Razia, you teach an undergraduate class on democracy. Would you say your students are putting what they've learned into practice?
Hi, Georgina. I don't know that my students in particular were particularly engaged in what was happening on campus. A lot of the student-led protests at Princeton in particular, not necessarily in other places, and I've been to other encampments too, are led by postdoc students and supported by faculty. There are a fair few undergrads at Princeton. But, you know, in my class, there were students who felt, a couple of students felt uneasy about the sit-in and the encampment. And in fact, in my last class, I suggested to them that for the final part of the class, it's a three-hour seminar, that we go and sit and listen to a Palestinian law professor, Noura Erekat, speaking at the sit-in, which had only started that day on my final class. And I gave them the option, and one of them decided not to come, and the others all came. And I think a lot of them wrote to me afterwards and said, you know, it was really out of our comfort zone. We're really glad you suggested that we go. So in my particular class, I would not say that they reflect the kind of tone and tenor of those who had made a decision to initiate the encampment, which was disbanded very quickly, but they still are there as a kind of sit-in every day. They just don't sleep there overnight, and they're not allowed to have tents, which is very particular to Princeton. And I think a couple of other places too, where they've made encampments illegal. So yeah, I don't think my class was particularly reflective of it, but they were really engaged with the idea when we did talk about it.
Mm. And I wonder, in conversations with staff members, how large is the support for the students?
That's a really interesting question, because there is a solid core of, I would say, 150 upwards of faculty who are in support of the student protest. There are lots of people. I mean, I certainly spoke to somebody in, for example, the geosciences department, where the professor was willing to speak to me and was part of the support and solidarity for the students, but was astonished that since October the 7th in his department, nobody had spoken about what was happening in the outside world. And he said, you know, you can argue that we're in the world of natural sciences, but from his perspective, there's an atrocity taking place outside in the world. And how can we, in fact, he made the comparison with climate change and the idea that there is this demand that we all engage with what's happening with the natural world, and yet you can't persuade people to engage even in conversation. He wasn't demanding that people go and protest or sign petitions. He was just saying there was no conversation. So I think it's probably fair to say that in large parts inside Princeton, it's a pretty politically apathetic community, and sometimes kind of indifferent, but it does have these kind of moments when students become engaged and faculty decide that they want to support that engagement, particularly with divestment in South Africa, when that country was living under apartheid. And the Black Lives Matter movement also energized students. So there are these kind of eruptions, but I wouldn't say that it has the same kind of political culture in the student body as, say, Berkeley or Columbia or NYU.
I mean, it's interesting you bring up South Africa, because the strikers say that they're drawing their protests from the tradition of Palestinian political protesters going on saltwater-only hunger strikes in Israeli prisons since 1968. So 68 was also the peak of the protests against the Vietnam War. And I wonder about the parallels to that, or is this more in line with the anti-apartheid movement against South Africa?
You know, I think the students that I've spoken to at Princeton and indeed elsewhere, it does strike me that they are drawing on a variety of historical protest movements in this country. I mean, certainly the parallels with Vietnam are clear in terms of it being two things. I mean, you described it as pro-Palestinian in your introduction. I would say that every single student I've spoken to talks about this as an anti-war protest, first of all. Secondly, they talk about it in the context of divestment, and that has parallels with Vietnam too. The students at Princeton have had a meeting with the president, President Chris Eisgruber, and some deans, and they have tried to focus on divestment, and the university has responded by saying, there is a process. We have looked at divestment in terms of Israel in the past. There was not consensus on campus, either in the student body or with the faculty, and we abandoned it. So they're trying to focus on process, and the students are saying there is an urgency here. It may have been discussed in 2014, but we need you to look at it with real urgency now. And they also want the silence over the ceasefire. You know, no university in this country has called for a ceasefire, and universities argue that they must remain neutral in issues like this. But, you know, they haven't remained neutral in other instances. And you could argue that in this instance, more than any other, it's universities that should speak out, because universities in Gaza have been destroyed systematically, according to people who look at this with care. Something like 12 universities have been completely destroyed, physically destroyed. Libraries are being destroyed. So many people inside the academy feel that here is a place where the academy can actually weigh in and say something about this aspect of the destruction inside Gaza. And students feel that too. You know, if you're not going to speak out over what they're describing as scholasticide, then when are you going to speak out? I think there is a real fervor of, you know, what is a university for, especially in places like Columbia, where you've got lockdowns, and Harvard Yard, where people aren't allowed to walk through. You know, I think that there is a genuine feeling of what is the role of universities here in civil society if you're not going to speak out about something that is not just affecting other scholars in the world, but there's a kind of cultural dimension to what the role of universities should be in any society that is coming to the fore as well.
Finally, Raza, here in Britain, the universities of Oxford and Cambridge have joined in the protest this weekend, now that the British Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, told university leaders that governments expect them to take swift action where necessary to ensure the safety of staff and students. Now, you've observed the clampdown in the US. How would you advise law enforcement in this country to proceed? What lessons can be learned from what's been happening in America?
And I think it's a different situation in one respect. A lot of these universities are private institutions. So it's up to the administration, in the case of, say, Princeton and Harvard and Columbia, to call in the federal police forces, and in those cases they have done so, and I think in the UK it's a slightly different thing because they're all public universities. You know, what advice would I give them? It's not for me to give any law enforcement advice, but I do think that the key issue here is not, it's not so much about the kind of physical safety, which everyone makes a really big deal about, because even the New York Police Department have said that the Columbia students were completely peaceful, right? And it is other people who are, it's politicians who talk about the safety of all students. They talk about people feeling unsafe, people feeling harmed, and so on. And the minute you start using that language, you deflect from the absolute right of people to protest and the right of everyone to feel that what they are saying is respected. You know, freedom of speech only means something if you protect the rights of those that you don't agree with. And if politicians don't agree with the prevailing sentiment of the protesters, you should at least have the wherewithal in a democratic country to protect their right to say it.
Razia, thank you very much indeed. That was Razia Iqbal in Boston. You're listening to The Briefing. Today marks the first semi-final for this year's Eurovision. One of the most exotic entries is certainly Finland. The act is called Windows 95 Man, with his entry No Rules, a Eurodance delight that involves hot pants and a giant denim egg. Our very own Eurovision correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Windows 95 Man and his collaborator Henri Pispanan.
My name is Windows, Windows 95 Man, and I only live by one rule, and the rule is... No rules! No rules!
It's also me, Teemu Keisteri, and then it's Windows 95 Man. It's just like a mega mix, like a Superman version of myself. Like, it's give the permission to be no rules when I'm Windows 95 Man. When I put the hot pants on, I'm always feeling like a happy, free man person.
I think this is very important. I mean, because we should all be free when we wear hot pants. And it's interesting because you come across as a man with no rules, but you are at Eurovision Song Contest, right? There are a set of rules. There are a lot of things you have to follow. How was it for you as an artist to do that as well?
This has been really crazy school for me to kind of, because Windows 95 Man is more than 10 years old, so I'm using a lot of improvisation and I love to break the rules. And with this project, I've been need to learn so much to follow all kind of like choreography and all kind of stuff. So it's something really, really, really interesting and really challenging mindset sometimes when there is a lot of technical stuff, and it's good practice to still like just focus to be yourself and not care about the small things, but because those doesn't matter.
All I can say, I like a rule breaker. But Henry, tell us, how did you meet actually Windows 95 Man, and how did you guys work out with this contribution with your amazing vocals?
Well, at first I saw Windows 95 Man at DJ gig. He didn't see me, but I'm aware of him. We met actually through this project, and I was asked to produce the song. Then I did demo vocals, and apparently they were so good that I needed to
Too good.
Say,
Too yeah. good.
But I want to talk about the music itself, Windows 95 Man, because I feel that this dance music, Eurodance from the 90s, it's coming back. And you know, I was there as well in the 90s. I love this type of music. So what is your biggest music influences? Is that 90s Eurodance vibes, or tell us a bit more about your other music inspirations?
Yeah, I'm just all over the just 90s, all kind of Eurodance and rave and all the electronic music. Like everybody else was like kind of listening Finnish radio pop, but I went to libraries and find all kind of like Dutch hardcore techno and happy hardcore and like all the rave stuff and all the Eurodance. I always just was listening and be always just listening electronic music. So this is just like really natural way to go back to my childhood, and I had a happy childhood. So it's nice to be almost 40 and just live in nostalgia, because why not? If it makes me happy, why not?
Yes, we should chase happiness, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
talking about happiness, I want to talk about both of your outfits. We spoke about yours, Windows 95 Man, and that's very cool. I mean, so how is it going to work on the big day? Because I know it's Windows 95, but you can't really show the brand. So they might have to blur a little bit. Or how does that work?
A couple of years ago, when I was performing in a Swedish national TV program, where they're really strict with the brands. So I already had my studio already like printed T-shirt with the pixelated Windows 95 logo. So it was like easy peasy. I was just like going to my studio. Okay, no worries. Let's use my... I have already this Pixel Man. So it was really easy decision. And then I think like my character is... There is so big power to give the joyness for the people. It's in the end, it doesn't matter so much what is in my shirt. So I can still give the energy out of me.
Absolutely. And here I have to say, I have to commend you for your denim usage. I think especially the short shorts, because short shorts are back for 2024 as well.
Yeah, definitely.
But a question to both of you. How was the reaction from Finland about your victory? Because the public loved it. I mean, I know Kadia announced the results. They're also very great, Kadia. But how the song is being perceived in Finland? And I want to know more about the local reaction.
Like a lot of emotions that it separates people a little bit, like that you either love it or people maybe hate it. I don't know. I haven't read in half year any news anymore or something like that. But I don't know. It's. I'm just so happy. I'm seeing so many like kind of fan videos. Just today I saw from Finnish countryside, some library made some no rules video in library where they breaks all the library rules. And it's so cute. And so fantastic. And that gives me so much energy when like kind of people get my message. And it's been so this is so nice.
Yeah, and the denim egg was a word of the month in March, I guess, in Finnish.
It's a big egg. I mean, how big is it actually?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe like 3 meters.
Something like that, yeah.
Even more.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco in conversation with the Finnish Eurovision entry, Windows 95 Man. We'll be hearing more from Fernando as he heads to Malmo for the competition this weekend. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing, which was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Lily Austin. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Georgina Godwin. Goodbye and thanks for listening.